Now, anyone who's remotely interested in aircraft, as you know I am, being a bit of an aircraft nut, will basically hold this Spitfire up as probably one of the most legendary aircraft ever built. There's a brand new book about it. It's called Spitfire, A Very British Love Story. And the man who's written it is a bit of a legend himself, Royal Air Force's John Nicoll, who flew Tornadoes in both the air defence and ground attack roles during 15 years service in the Royal Air Force. And we remember the images of John paraded on television, which provoked worldwide condemnation in the first Gulf War in 1991 when he was captured and tortured. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome John to the programme. Good morning, John.
Bill, thanks so much for having me on. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, as a lowly private pilot, it's an honour to have you on, sir, and to be and to be talking about a machine which I have admired so many times stood next to in places like Duxford. I remember flying into Duxford once and having to hold on finals because a Spitfire was about to land, and I said, "I'll hold as long as you like, as long as I can look at it."
But, I mean, you mentioned Duxford, and it's kind of quite interesting because Duxford was almost where the whole book started, in actual fact. Because I was at Duxford with a veteran, a Spitfire veteran, a few years ago, but now about 4 years ago, doing a TV program.
Yes.
And, as you said, I mean, I was in the Air Force, and I knew, you know, I've written quite a lot of books before, but I took this 90-year-old Spitfire veteran there, and a friend of mine, my old station commander, Air Marshal Cliff Spink, was taking him flying in the Spitfire for me as a little TV thing. And whilst I knew about the Spitfire, I kind of didn't really know the full story behind its incredible war during the Second World War. But when Cliff fired this Spitfire up, and you know what Duxford like, for the people that don't, it's a huge, big airfield. Yep. There are aviation exhibitions all over. There's loads of aircraft out.
And a museum, the museum there, of course, as well. Yeah,
museum. Yeah. And so when the Spitfire fired up, I watched a phenomenon take place. Because people turned away from the exhibits, and they started running towards the sound.
Wow.
Because this aircraft with this incredible noise of its engine, totally unique, totally iconic, and they were running and they were dragging their kids with them, and they were, you know, Spitfire pointing, and they were pulling their cameras out of their bag. And I thought, wow. what? And that was the start of the book. I wanted to know why. Why did people run towards the Spitfire? Why did people stop and stare? Why did people stop and point?
Unless, of course, you were German, in which case you ran away from them quite fast in the opposite direction. Yes.
The Spitfire was legendary on both sides of the water.
Yeah, this was Brian Bird, who was a 90-year-old RAF veteran who hadn't flown a Spitfire for nearly 70 years.
Yeah, he hadn't flown a Spitfire since he climbed out in. When would it be? Probably April 1945, May 1945, just at the end of the war. His last operational sortie. He was a flight sergeant, young flight sergeant, pilot. Climbed out. Obviously, most of them at the end of the war were simply, demobbed. We got rid of most of them.
Yeah.
They went back to their jobs as accountants and as clerks and as technicians and as road sweepers. They all went back from flying Spitfires.
Incredible.
And he'd never got in one before. And so, you know, he was in a care home. He'd been in a hospital. He'd had a hip replacement. He was on he arrived with Matron from the Royal British Legion home where he was in a wheelchair. And he was out that wheelchair like a rat up a drain.
Oh, I bet he was.
Skipping around. It was amazing.
Seeing
the transformation.
I mean, the as a pilot, it scares the living daylights out of me to imagine people with very few flying hours getting into this machine, which is so powerful, and having to not just get the thing up and down, but to then fight with it.
Fight it, yeah. And so, you said as a mere PPL, well, you're one up on me because I was a navigator. Nobody ever let me take the controls. So first of all, so Brian served towards the end of the war, and they got a bit more training, but I interviewed a couple of the Battle of Britain pilot, sadly now dead. And that's one of the tragedies of the book in one way, in that I interviewed about 40 pilots and only three survive now because they are a diminishing generation. But Bernard Brown came from New Zealand. So he came from New Zealand to fly in 1938 because he knew the war was going to happen. As he was a 19-year-old, and he had 15 hours flying training. Oh. Not on the Spitfire. He had 15 hours flying training.
Wow. And that's kind of for our listeners who really don't know this, but 15 hours used to be about the average where the instructor would leave the aircraft and say, okay, it's time for your very first solo circuit.
Yeah, and he simply, and he had a basic flying training, so he knew how to fly, and he said, right, you know, they're your muggins, there's your Spitfire, don't take it off. And so basically he arrived at the Spitfire training base, did two or three trips in the Spitfire, and he was sent off to the front line. And he arrived literally in the midst of the Battle of Britain, with bombs going off, with burning buildings at the airfield, Biggin Hill, I think it was.
Yeah.
And he got into the officers, into the sergeant's mess, and they were clearing. You know, in the old-fashioned, they had mailboxes, wooden, where your mail went in.
Yeah.
So people would put your mess bill in there, or your letter from your mum, or something like
right.
that. And there was somebody clearing mailboxes out. And he said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, they were killed today."
So
he got one of the recently killed bloke's mailboxes.
Oh my goodness me!
That was his introduction, with a handful of hours to then get up in a Spitfire, take it airborne, and fight hundreds and hundreds of German bombers
heading over the
channel.
And this is an aircraft, to put it in perspective, which can reach about 450 miles an hour in some of its forms, you know, where the kind of aircraft you learn in are probably doing 100, 110, something like that.
Oh,
they're pootling along, you know. But this was a beast of an aircraft.
It was a very, very, very powerful aircraft, very manoeuvrable. To try to put it in for your listeners, it's like, I don't know, maybe doing some basic driving in a little smart car or something like that.
Yeah.
So somebody takes you out around the supermarket car park, you know, when you're down at your mum's when you first went. And so you go around a little smart car, a little two-seater, 10 mile an hour.
Yeah.
And then somebody suddenly gives you a Formula One car and says, right, get out on the racetrack and race against Ayrton Senna.
Oh.
That's what it was like for these guys.
Wow. Good description, actually. It's a very good analogy. So we have the Spitfire. We, of course, also had the Hurricane, but the Spitfire was the one, wasn't it? They're quite similar-looking aircraft. But what was it, John, about the Spitfire that made it so iconic? Was it simply because its role was so vital that we probably we've been having a different conversation now if it wasn't for that aircraft?
That is an excellent question. People who love the Hurricane will tell you that the Hurricane has been unfairly forgotten.
Mm.
Many other iconic RAF aircraft, the Lancaster, of course, many, many iconic RAF aircraft. The Spitfire was iconic for a couple of different reasons. So first of all, again, Cliff Spink, who took Brian flying for me, he put it this way. He said, the Spitfire was a heroic aircraft when the country needed heroes.
Mm.
The country needed heroes in its men and its women, and it needed heroes it could look at and say, that is something that is going to protect us. And the Spitfire, that it became an icon during the war. And the second thing is, it was because it was part of a government spin campaign to make it iconic.
Right.
The government launched a spin campaign to focus the war effort on the Spitfire. And so you could buy a Spitfire.
Mm.
This back in 1939, 1940. You could donate to a Spitfire fund.
Ah.
So in all sorts of different ways. So I think something like, if you had £2,000, so basically when the annual salary was, I think, something like £100 or something, if you had £2,000, you could buy an engine and donate, you could donate it. If you had sixpence, you could buy a rivet.
Oh.
And the money came from... So it was launched. There were posters all over. The Spitfire Fund, it was called. Fund the war. Great British public, fund the war. And many other ways. So, for instance, How did prostitutes help to fund the Spitfire?
Go on.
Prostitution helped to fund the Spitfire because in Manchester, if you were a prostitute and you got caught plying your trade in the 1930s and 1940s,
right.
you were offered the option of either going to court and being fined.
Yeah.
Or you could donate £3 to the Spitfire Fund.
Magnificent.
And so prostitution helped to fund the Spitfire. And do you know, basically, the Spitfire Fund, during the course of the war, raised £13 million.
What?
Do you know what that would be worth today?
Go on.
£650 million.
Good.
So a government spin campaign raised £650 million
wow.
to build Spitfires for the war effort.
Maybe they should get whoever designed that campaign to have a go with the NHS then, actually, John.
Well, they could do anything. They could do NHS. They could do... if they could just sort anything. It's amazing that it happened then.
Wow, I had no idea about that. And, of course, at the time we're talking about here, you know, Adolf Hitler was pretty convinced that his Messerschmitts and his Heinkels would outclass anything that the Royal Air Force threw at them, and we'd basically be defeated in the skies over the south of England. He was convinced about that, wasn't he?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, he was told, Göring told him, the head of the Luftwaffe, the head of the Nazi Air Force, told him that, you know, the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, could defeat the Royal Air Force easily and ergo make the invasion across the Channel. It was meant to be happening in the mid 1940s.
Yeah.
And you know, at a couple of points, they nearly did.
Wow.
You know, they nearly did. It became quite close on a couple of occasions. And it was the battle for Britain, the Battle of Britain, was so crucial to the war effort. There were many, many, many crucial battles.
Sure.
But the Battle of Britain, to protect Britain from invasion at that early stage of the war, was absolutely crucial. And the country was on a knife edge on a couple of occasions. And it was the bravery of the young men, mostly young 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds going up there. Obviously, thousands were killed in the air and on the ground. It was their bravery, their skill, and no doubt about it, a huge amount of luck that stopped them.
Incredible. And those of us who are not old enough to have been around then, and you've spoken to people who were flying those aircraft at the time, when we watch films about the Battle of Britain, the film 633 Squadron, all that, we kind of think, well, it can't have been like that, can it? But it was. The sky was full of aircraft fighting each other.
It was. I spoke to a couple of the guys, and one of them said... they got scrambled. You've seen the old film. Somebody would ring a bell and they would all run off. And it was like that. There's no doubt about it. And they got scrambled for an incoming raid. And they said their squadron, so what, 10, 15 aircraft, got airborne and headed out towards the south coast. And he said, and I looked and I saw in the distance what a swarm of hornets, a swarm of mosquitoes. And I couldn't understand what I was seeing. Oh. And he said, and they got closer, and he realized that it was 600, 700, 800 German bombers heading towards the coast.
Good grief.
And it was just like, he said, it's just a swarm. And of course, then the German fighters are protecting the bombers. So you could have, you know, maybe 800, 900 aircraft in the sky at once.
Good God.
And it was, and clearly, many of them got through, but these young men... who'd seen so much, who did so much. And for many of them, they were mere teenagers.
Yeah.
A chap called Alan Peart, Alan's one of the few that's still alive, he came over from, again, New Zealand, never travelled, never been away from his little town in New Zealand, came over determined to protect what he regarded as his homeland.
Amazing.
Even though New Zealand was his homeland.
Amazing.
But it had been his father's homeland. And he ended up actually in Burma in the Far East, fighting in the Far East. And Alan was scrambled to meet a Japanese raid that was coming in. They thought there was four Japanese fighters, so he and his wingman took off. His wingman was immediately shot down. On takeoff, his wingman was shot down. So Alan was left to face this incoming raid. And it wasn't four Japanese fighters. It was 20 Japanese fighters.
Good God.
And Alan was left to face 20 Japanese fighters on his own. Incredible. And it is one of the stories in the book. It is one of the greatest untold stories of military aviation. It's an astonishing story that he fought, won, survived. But Alan had never kissed a girl.
Wow.
So he was he fought for the whole of the war, and he'd never kissed a girl.
Oh.
That is how young, naive these men were, and yet so incredible in their capacity and their capability.
Extraordinary. And, you know, you mentioned your own career there as a navigator. You were flying tornadoes in air defence and ground attack roles in the Gulf War. A very different aircraft and a very different modus operandi that you were flying those technically advanced aircraft. Yeah. But, of course, you, as we now know, history has it, got shot down. And that's what happened to those kids back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, clearly, so I was shot down, first Gulf War, 1991, as you said, and lots of people will remember those pictures
that
myself and my pilot, John Peters, paraded on TV.
Yeah.
But, and you're right, the Tornado is, generations away from the Spitfire. But it was of its time. And so we young men, and of course now young women, rightly so, who are flying the Tornado, whilst the aircraft that we fly are just so far different, the ethos and the reality of war is the same.
Yeah.
As what it's the same. Because both sides are, I'm going to say on an even footing, I'm trying to explain, I'm probably not putting it right, but both sides have similar defenses. And so, yes, back in the 1940s, the Spitfires were against the Messerschmitts, or the Lancasters flew against the flak around Berlin.
Yeah.
Well, it was the same for us in the 1990s with our Tornadoes, when, you know, in the first Gulf War against Iraq. It is the same now with the young men and women flying the Typhoons in Syria or recently again. So the capabilities advance evenly on both sides, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So it is still about young men and women on two different sides of largely what becomes a political argument, putting their lives on their line for their country.
Absolutely. And as an aviator, I just need to kind of ask you, really, you know, you're in an aircraft, and the worst thing that can happen is having to get out of an aircraft when something goes horribly wrong. But to be shot down by enemy fire just must be a whole other world of pain in your head when it happens.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
I mean, the Tornado, so my pilot and I were flying at about, 600 miles an hour and about 30 feet over the desert, something like that.
30 feet?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And 600 miles, about 540 knots, so what's that? That's about 600 miles an hour, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if we were flying into a wall of exploding shells. And, you know, the aircraft hit, we nearly were killed because, you know, we were so close to the ground when it hit. But my pilot, with supreme skill, saved that situation. But the aircraft's on fire, all the controls are down, all the fly-by-wires down. Martin Baker, who invented the ejection seat, saved our lives.
Wow.
And the ejection seat's an amazing piece of equipment. When you eject, you've seen Top Gun, you've seen the images.
Yeah.
And so you pull a handle in the seat and technology takes over. And your arms are dragged in on restraining straps, your legs are dragged in into the seat on restraining straps. The Perspex cockpit above your head has got a little bomb running down the middle of it so it explodes so that you're open to the elements.
Mm.
The rocket motors in the seat fire. You accelerate from 0 to 200 miles an hour, upwards under 18 times the force of gravity in 1 second. So from pulling the handle to being ejected out of the aircraft to being in the parachute is 1.5 seconds.
Wow. Good grief.
Yeah.
People say to me, oh, have you ever done any parachute jumping? I say, why would you jump out of a perfectly serviceable aircraft? It's the most stupid idea in the world.
So I have done two parachute jumps. The first one was ejecting into the middle of enemy territory, so I had no choice.
Yeah.
The second one came about, and you'll be surprised about this, after a night in a bar with the RAF Falcons, which is the Air Force Parachute Display Team.
Yes.
And I had one quiet beer with them, followed it up with 10 extremely loud beers. And one of them said, oh, John, come and do a jump with us from 10,000 feet or something. And, of course, when you're full of lager, this is a great idea, let me tell you.
Oh, no.
It was more terrifying than being in the middle of a war. So it was a tandem jump with some of our RAF instructors.
Right.
And so I think it was 10,000 feet we did it from. So we were in free fall for something like 60 seconds.
Oh.
I have never, ever... ever in my life been so scared. It was horrible.
I'm kind of happy you said that, because it's made my fear rational now. That's really good.
why would you want to jump out of a perfectly serviceable aircraft?
Absolutely right. And to get back to our story about this amazing aircraft, the Spitfire, these guys, you know, didn't have the technology that you had, and there they are. They're being shot down. They're landing in fields in the middle of blooming nowhere.
Yep.
Just beyond belief. In your research for this, how many are left now that we know about? Do you know,
well,
Spitfires?
I mean, how many? Do you mean flying Spitfires?
Yeah.
I think people say worldwide, I think there's about 40. I think that's from World War II era original aircraft. It's about
right.
40. There are quite a few replicas that have been built.
Right.
But the costs now, so I think that I think the most recent one, which was an early version, kind of a 1939, 1940 version,
yeah.
Was auctioned a couple of years ago, and I think it went for something like £4 million.
Wow.
Bearing in mind that we had about 23,000 of these things, and most of them were simply thrown away, literally, and dumped. You could buy one, I think in the 70s, in the 60s, or 50s, I think you could buy one for £100 or something.
Good
because we
God.
Had thousands, and nobody wanted them. People say, why did you... We got rid of 23,000 Spitfires, you know. I think something like 15,000 Lancasters. Again, we simply cut them up, smashed them up for scrap.
Wow.
And people say, oh, my God, why did you do that? And I say, you have to imagine it's like this. It is like saying, why would you keep your old mobile phone?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why would you... When there's a new mobile phone, you don't think, oh, I'm going to keep my old... You know, I don't know, Panasonic Z3, the size of a brick.
Do you have to get rid of it? Yeah. Don't tell me that, John. It's in a cupboard.
But that's what we did with aircraft.
Yeah.
They were the mobile phones. The only one new one came along. Obviously, some of them get sent out to third world countries, and that's what happened with the aircraft. So Spitfire was still flying in Egypt in the 1950s, still fighting wars. In fact, I think, was it... Israel, I think it was Egypt, there was a Spitfire, the Spitfire combat at one point, in actual fact. Why would you keep them? Where would you store 23,000 Spitfires?
Yeah.
In the hope that 70 years later they'd be worth £3 million each.
Incredible. Incredible. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. And it's bizarre. Yesterday was the 6th anniversary of me leaving the UK to move to Spain. And bizarrely, on the day I left the UK, there was something going on that required a flypast of Buckingham Palace. Can't remember what it was now.
All right.
They departed Buckingham Palace to head back north to wherever they were going.
Yeah.
And two Spitfires and a Lancaster flew over my house on the day I left the UK to come to Spain. So own personal Spitfire flypast. There you go.
That would have been from the Battle of Britain Memorial flight.
It was absolutely that, yeah. Well, brilliant that you've been on. The book is great. Spitfire, A Very British Love Story. John Nicol, a pleasure to talk to you, sir, and thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Cheers. Bye-bye.